All right, so the movie that we have today is actually kind of short. It's only about an hour and 20 minutes or so. So what I'd like to do is listen to a couple pieces of music compressed so you can get an idea of what some different composers that have composed in this basic vein have done different, or a wide variety of different approaches. And then what I would like to do in particular is also listen to some of the pieces of music concrète that are used in the soundtrack of the movie we're going to watch today. It's a sort of interesting technique, not something that is actually done very often. I can't think of many other examples of this, where there is actually non-diegetic music, but the non-diegetic music is music concrète, that is, pieces of music made out of the sounds, recorded sounds of the world around us. It's, it creates a sort of interesting experience while we're watching the film, because it, it makes it really unclear, it's really ambiguous, what is sound effects and what is music, and whether the sound effects that you hear are intended to be actual, you know, sounds like doors or water, or birds, these sorts of things, whether they're in the story space or not. And in fact, sometimes, when I gave an example last week about a situation where a character is opening a door, but the musical soundtrack is a piece of music that uses the recordings of doors slamming. And so sometimes there are even situations where the images and the sound are in conflict with each other. It's kind of interesting. So, what I'd like to do, I'm going to play a brief piece by Pierre Schaeffer. It's on the Canvas page, so we won't listen to that much of it. You can go online and listen to the full piece if you would like to. Just so you can get sort of an idea of what different composers working in a music concrète aesthetic we're doing. Also, I'll mention, I uploaded some of the film clips from last week, the commutation test clips, so you can go online and watch them. The shiny one, I don't know what happened. The music actually was on the clip. For some reason, it wasn't playing back in class. But anyway, you can go online and see the clip now.
What's that music from?
I don't remember the title. It's from an anime.
From what?
It's from an anime. You thought it was what?
Some
gong-y. Oh, I see. Yeah, it's in that basic style. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. So, right. Me. Here. All right. So the first piece I'd like to play is one of the very first pieces that the originator of the term music concrète composed. The piece is called Railway Study, and I think it'll be pretty obvious immediately why it's called that. But it's sort of interesting to listen to the way that he uses the sounds in this piece. What he's essentially doing is trying to, since he's so interested in this this notion of like the ideal experience of the sound, sound for itself, the sound object, he has a very, one might say, foremost approach to the way that he composes. And one of the things that's interesting about it is that there's actually something that he does here which is very similar to the sorts of things that we see in the Beethoven Symphony, where we find a unity between part and whole, if you remember some of the things that I said about that before. And so we're only going to listen maybe to 1.5 minutes or so of this piece. I'd like you to see if you can figure out the way that the part and, at least on a very local level, the whole seem to, in some way, be similar to each other. You might think about the part being the actual specific recording of the sound he's using, and then think about what the characteristics are of that sound. We'll try to describe it in sort of reduced terms, just sort of formal, abstract terms, and then see if there's anything about the way he uses the sound or other sounds that seems to sort of be similar to the characteristics of the sound he's using.
All right. Here we go.
First of all, we can start with just a literal description of the sound that you heard. Let's try to be as specific as possible. Obviously, the sound comes from the train. So, but what are the specific sounds of the train that you heard?
It sounds
like the wheels clacking. You want to sing it for us? Yeah, there are a few different wheel sounds, but so that's one. We'll keep that in mind. What else?
The sound of the brakes were coming in while the wheels were going at the same time somehow.
Yeah, so brakes and wheels. So things oriented around the wheels and the tracks, basically. Right? Let's maybe get away from wheels and tracks. What other sounds, basic families of sounds, did you hear?
Yeah. There was also like the chugging engine.
Yeah, engine sounds.
Yeah.
Okay. How did it start? What's the very first sound that you heard?
High pitched something.
Wait, so that's a good way to describe it. And actually, this is the idea in academic music. You're not supposed to know what the sound is, right? If you do know what the sound is, it's kind of hard not to hear it as this thing. But the point of listening to these pieces in total darkness and using electronic media to manipulate the sound and, in fact, gain complete mastery over the sound is oriented towards this idea of somehow getting inside the nature of the sound itself, so that you can manipulate it and listen to, you know, you could, for instance, stretch out just a microsecond of the sound and listen to the structure of the sound if you want to. That's basically the idea here. So it is important in this aesthetic that you not be able to identify the sound. Nonetheless, I'll bet if you think about it, it's probably a good candidate for what the sound would be. A whistle! Yeah, a train whistle, right. Yeah, very good. There's one other family of sounds that didn't say yet, although it's maybe a little unclear. I don't think it's brakes. I think that, what's the last sound that you heard? Daniel.
It's a very like mechanical, like,
yeah,
I don't know what it is.
Yeah, very good.
It's
yeah.
very repetitive, but dynamic. Like, there's definitely different aspects to it.
Well, maybe one way to describe the dynamism is just to say it's rhythmic, right? There's a, you know, there's a louder part and a softer part of it. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly what that is. I think it's like some kind of door, like a door on a train, perhaps, being. But I would open or close, it's a little hard to say. Right. Well, already you see one of the basic ideas that Pierre is interested in getting at, the way that when you listen to sounds without those sources, we really don't even know what the sounds are. It kind of forces us to listen to the sounds musically. Now, there's a second question that I asked, which is about the characteristics of, say, some of the first sounds, maybe after the whistle. And what the way that you seem to be manipulating the piece, and if there's any sort of connection, any sort of similarity between the actual characteristics of the sound and the way it's manipulating the piece. Okay, so let's talk about the train, the wheels on the track. And I'm not at, you know, this class doesn't require any previous musical knowledge, so really just use whatever the most basic terms you can think of.
It's very rhythmic and repetitive.
Yes, exactly. Very rhythmic and repetitive. And in particular, very repetitive. What you think about what the sound of train on track, what it sounds like, is, well, you know, I can't really sing it very well, but it has that very repetitive mechanical regularity, right? But that's not as characteristic about the sound itself. We don't even have to know that it's a train on a track to hear that regularity, that repetitive quality. So, how does this thing then to connect the next sort of higher level of manipulation? What is he doing to the sounds that somehow seems to be mirroring the characteristic of the underlying sound itself?
And then he loops it.
Yeah, exactly.
The other sounds also
connect. Yeah. What he's doing is cutting up the tape in shorter and shorter segments and looping those segments. So, you start with a longer sound that is actually just characteristic. A characteristic of the sound is that it's mechanical and repetitive. And then what he does is start chopping up the tape, splicing it together so that you get shorter and shorter loops. sort of in a way builds up tension, perhaps. This is very similar to the sort of thing that Beethoven does, Mozart does this as well, in his symphonies. Do you remember how I was talking about, say, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, where, you know, you take the very opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, da-da-da-da, and you go throughout the whole symphony and you find that again and again, on various levels of the symphony, he's varying that motive, he's creating variations out of that motive. It's basically the same thing that Pierre Schaeffer is doing here. He's taking a sound as a motive, basically, the sound of a train on the tracks. And then, in a way, extrapolating from the characteristics of that sound onto higher levels of structure of the piece. And so there's this similar sort of relationship between part and whole going on here. Last time, if you remember, I won't play it again this time. It's on the website, so you can listen if you want. It's very interesting what happens when you take that looping technique and apply it to human speech. And we played an example of this last time, where you take a two-word fragment and you repeat it over and over, you loop it over and over, suddenly it turns into music. You sort of become saturated by the semantic content of what the words mean, and you start to just sort of get entrained into the meter, into the regular repetitive meter of the loops, and you start to hear a melodic contour that comes out. And even so much so that when you then play the original back at the moment that you get to the part that had been looped, it sounds almost like he's about to burst into song all around the way. Okay. So that's another interesting approach to music concrète. One of the things that nobody's asked this time, but one of the things that's sort of interesting is how to use music in a piece of music concrète. And there are a variety of ways to do this, but I think it's most interesting if you don't at least not only use the music as sort of non-diegetic soundtrack, as sort of, you have sounds of people fighting and you have some action history in the background. I think it's very interesting to try to use music actually as a sound object itself. Right? Which means that in some way try to either use the music as just some sort of abstract background, or perhaps use the music as, diegetically, use it as sort of a found sound. For instance, you might have a scene where there is music actually taking place in the scene, in your piece, and then at another point you might take that same music and combined with some other sounds to create a musical texture, or you might then perhaps even turn it into non-diegetic music, this sort of thing. I'm going to play a brief excerpt of a piece. It's a very short excerpt from a piece that's about 20 minutes long. This clip is about 2 minutes long. It's a piece that I wrote a few years ago. And what I'd like you to do is to see if you can, try to classify the different sounds that you hear in terms of their formal characteristics, in terms of their sources. But in particular, try to see if you can find any connections between the music that's used. There's actual music that's, I suppose, quoted or just sort of taken as an object in this part of the piece. But it's combined with other non-musical sounds in a way that is actually musical. And so we want to listen to all the various sort of noisy sounds, the sounds that you don't necessarily think of as being music, but how are they related to the music that you hear, the sounds that are unequivocally musical. And I should perhaps explain, there are two distinct things going on in this piece, because it's a piece for a live piano and electronics. So you will hear some piano sounds, but it won't be really obvious necessarily how the piano is being played. And there are also sort of extended techniques. So that's one of the things that connects the musical sounds, the sounds of the piano, to the noises that you hear. But there are other things going on as well.
All right. Okay, so what I heard was there was a lot of
voices. There was like a kind
so
of
people singing.
Yes, people singing voices.
Yeah,
there was a, like, sort of the creaking noise, like and then there was like also like very. It sounded like one of those. What are they called? Die. What is, they're like the. They have the pole and. You sort of like put your hand and it like makes the noises, whatever they're called.
Yeah,
it kind of sounds like that. It's like, or it's like sound of like it's electronic noise.
Yeah,
it's a high pitch electronic.
This is one of the sad things about digital technology that nobody has any experience with analog radios anymore.
Yeah, it was a radio.
Yeah, right. What did you say?
It's the not new
one. Not new one, I know. But, yeah. Right. Yeah, so there's some pretty electronic-y sound. There's some very synthetic sounds and some more musical sounds, and then also human singing. What about the relationship between clearly musical stuff and stuff that sounded like it's noise? Did anybody perhaps try to suggest what's going on here in terms of the sounds that they have? So, what are the radio sounds that you heard? Singing. Try to describe the radio sounds that you
heard. It kind of builds up to a climax and then you stop, and then it's a pretty sharp drop. And I heard some, like, either a person whispering or a single bird whistle. And so I noticed that.
What kind of whistle?
Like a bird, kind of.
A bird or something. Oh, I see.
It's like a single bird, like a chorus. It was just one.
Yeah.
Or it was
a single. Well, right. Maybe just since we'll run out of time if I have everybody guess what's going on here, I'll tell you what the sounds are, and then we can try to see if we can see what the musical relationships are. So, a few different sounds. The sound of the piano. The piano's not being played in the normal way. It's,
you know, you have a lot of sounds like strumming on the strings, like this kind of thing. And then also getting harmonics, high pitches from the low strings. That's the main thing that's happening, those two sounds on the piano.
There are sounds of radios, the radio fuzz. That sound. There's the choir. And basically everything else are sounds from the NASA website where you can, it's actually really interesting. Pitts Labor kind of sent out a probe. The probes tend to collect radio frequencies and record them. And then somebody at NASA turns them into wave files and pitch shifts everything down to the human auditory spectrum, and you get all these weird, sort of spacey kind of electronic chattery sounds. And so there's a lot of that. And so, like, the bird sound that you heard was from some space, or by like a casino or something like that. Or one of the probes that went to the moons of Jupiter. Because the idea of this piece, just very briefly, is that it was commissioned for the 400th anniversary of when Galileo demonstrated the telescope. And there are, it's like a 20-minute piece, but the piece of music in here was written the same year. The choral piece that you hear was written by Father Malteri in the early 17th century. So, it also uses space probes we heard data from flybys of Jupiter and its moons, which, if you know anything about Galileo's telescope, one of the things that he did is demonstrate the four moons of Jupiter through the telescope. So, I don't know if it was through the telescope. Yeah, this must be. But anyway, so those are the sounds that we have. Now, what about the musical connections? How are things connected musically? Well, there should be one really obvious one. What about the sound of the piano and all the electronic sounds? Is the sound of this? What?
They seem to be kind of reinforcing each other, like you try to make the piano make the second sound.
Yeah, so if you can go onto the website, and this is whenever this happens on the piano, it's combined with the radio status there. You know, and the keys are together really well, they're very similar. And this sound here, this. The sounds of satellites that are very similar. I'll show you later. I can show you after class. I have this one. So that's one of the things, just for sonic similarity between the piano and these electronic sounds. Also, one of the things that you might notice is that the radio set, well, you don't notice it actually. In fact, if I didn't do this, if I made it more natural, more realistic, you would notice the difference. But since I alter the radio sounds artistically, you don't actually notice that I've altered them. What I basically did was pitch shift the sound of the radio stat to fit in the harmonies of the choral piece. Mm-hmm. Right? So that when the choir is singing and then they kind of disintegrate into the sound of the static is one of the pitches from the last chord that they sang. But you don't hear it because it fits together so well. If it were just the standard, I don't know, you know, 60 hertz or whatever the frequency of radio static is at, you totally notice the difference. But it's because they're smoothed out, blended together. One of the ways that you do that is by having the same pitch between the radio and the choir. You don't notice that it's been altered in that way. There are a few other things happening which would take a little bit more time to describe, but one of the interesting things to notice is that almost every sound that you use, every sound that you download from FreeSound, for instance, is going to have some element of pitch in it. Pitch just means whatever the note is, whatever like a continuous frequency. And what's very interesting is that, you know, you could take sounds of radio waves and turn them into major triads if you wanted. And what's interesting about that is that it doesn't really sound like a major triad in a normal way, because major triads usually sound very stable. But it's because the quality of the sound that you play the triad, let's say the strings on a piano, are very stable. So if you know anything about string physics, they're very periodic, and the overtones of the string are in a really nice integer relationship to each other. And that creates the sensation that the sound is really stable, sounds really, you know, kind of nice and beautiful and so on. But if you take some sound of noise, what you'll find is that it's got a bunch of, it's very harsh sound for a variety of different musical reasons. What's interesting is if you take a harsh pitched sound, but put it together in a consonant harmony, then you have this weird thing where it's a consonant harmony, but it still sounds dissonant anyway. Because the sound itself is dissonant, even though the frequencies that you're hearing seem to spell out a consonant harmony. So these are some of the sorts of things you can play around with tasks if you're going to find in your new term project.
I think that in the interest of time, well, let's see, we have a couple minutes, so I will play just one brief piece. Not even a whole piece, just about 2 or 3 minutes or so from one of the pieces that's featured in the movie tonight, Elephant. It's a piece by Hildegard Bestekamp called Doors of Perception. And one of the very interesting things about this piece, it's based on the sounds of doors. So nearly everything that happens in the piece is somehow related to doors opening, closing, squeaking, entering or leaving spaces. But one of the very interesting things that you can do sonically, which you can't really do very well visually, is have continuous sound, sort of a continuous sonic scene, in which you elide space. It's a very strange thing. Because what you can do, you'll hear this in the piece, and I'm just going to explain it instead of trying to draw out what you guys heard just for the sake of time. One of the things you'll hear is that, for instance, someone will enter a space, and you'll hear a bell very often in the distance. And it's a continuous recording, a sense of continuous flow of time. It doesn't seem like there are jump cuts or anything like that. But one of the things that's very interesting is by just
situating the sound together, you can create a situation in which a sound that's very distant in a very rapid amount of time can become very close. And she creates this very strange, but very subtle experience of passing through various spaces in a way that's really non-realistic. And that's one of the things that using music and credit as a compositional device can allow you to do. For instance, maybe an easier way to think about this is, you know, you can, and I think something like this even happens in the piece, you hear a door open, and there's the sound of, like, I don't know, a train station or an airport or something. You hear the door close, and you hear it open again, and now it's the sound of a forest or something like that, right? So this is another way. Now, this is something that you could do visually. But these are the sorts of things that approaches to how you describe space in sound or in an arbitrary way that can be quite interesting when they deal with the sorts of things that are impossible in everyday experience. Maybe one of the, not necessarily, I mean, there's some people who do this quite well, but generally for me, it's less interesting if you describe a space completely accurately and completely realistically. Because that's the way we experience the world in it, generally, right? In a piece of music, you can do all sorts of crazy things, things that should be impossible. Maybe
kind of a fun way to think about how to explore the sounds of a space in your project. So we'll just listen to a couple minutes of this, and then I'll make two or three preliminary remarks about the movie, and we'll get started watching that. So this is the first section of Doors of Perception by Hildegard Festerkamp. It's about that that are sort of cool. Beyond sort of colliding space in the way that I described, she also superimposes spaces at times, so it's not always just that you open the door and you're in one space, you close it, you open it again in a different space. But one of the things you might remember is the first space that we hear, or one of the first spaces, sounds like maybe a train station or an airport, and you've got that thing that sounds like an announcement, like ba ba ba, right, that thing. But then later on, after she closes that door and opens another door, and we're in a space that, for me, at first sounds like it's going to be a barn door, like it sounds like a cow, but then it's not that the sound changes, my perception changes, so that what sounds like a cow, then I realize is actually like a race car or something like that. But you notice one of the sounds from the last space, the announcement melody, is then superimposed over that. So it's like these superimposed spaces. She does the same sort of thing with the bell. So you hear the bell very far off in the distance, and in only a few seconds, you're inside the church and you hear the people reciting, the part of the liturgy they're reciting. And then it sounds like maybe the camera or the microphone leaves the space and the bells are much louder. But then the bells in their loud situation are superimposed back on the sound of the church congregation. Right? So there are all sorts of weird ways of playing around with our perception of space. But again, you know, the idea of the doors of perception, where our perception changes relative to sounds when you listen to them in this reduced or aesthetic way. I gave a second ago the example of the thing that sounded kind of like a cow, and I realized was a race car, but also when you're listening to Performance 33 Seconds a couple of days ago, one of the things that I noticed very palpably was not that the sounds actually did get louder, but I became more aware of the presence of the sounds in the room, and my experience of them, in a sense, was that they got louder, at least more present, but it's because my perceptions changed, not the sounds themselves. So these are some very interesting ways of playing around with perception in a piece of music and credit.
Do you think there's any physical response to silence the way that there is, you know, we build up our awesomeness as night falls?
Wait, I didn't hear what you said.
You mean like,
you're adjusting to the silence? Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, our bodies have a physical.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I just know that from experience that that's the case. You know, I'm sure that there are plenty of studies on that as well. I can't cite any off the top of my head, but yeah. Jealous of my experience, certainly. It's just that most people, even musicians, tend to be visually oriented first. Vision tends to be the predominant sense. And so very often we don't notice that we do become accustomed, or that our ears do sort of gradually adjust to the sounds around us, because we may not be paying attention to that. But the fact that, for instance, it's great seeing, have you seen the Blues Brothers? Okay. You know when Elwood comes home from prison and he's staying in his brother's apartment and the L train goes by and it completely like breaks all the windows and just, you know, rumbles the apartment, and then Elwood says, "How often does the train go by?" And his brother says, so often you won't notice it anymore. Okay. Well, we have that experience all the time. In a way, it's sort of the opposite of what you're describing, but when a sound is very present and continuous, we tend to, in a way, lose sight of it. I think the same can be said for ears adjusting to silence, and I think it was, it's quite plausible. Good. Okay. So, just a couple things to pay attention to watch for in the movie tonight. There are, and I'm going to talk about these in more detail tomorrow, but it's good to sort of keep an eye and an ear open for these sorts of things while we're watching the movie. Since we're sort of in between Nietzsche and existentialism, I'll go back to some of the ideas that I presented with Nietzsche, this idea of experiencing the moment in its fullness, right? The way that, for instance, the big picture can get in the way of the moment. If we think of the big picture as the thing that justifies or explains the meaning of the moment. So how does that perhaps play a role in the various elements of this movie? In the way that the story is told, one of the things you'll find out is that it's a very nonlinear story. So there's a very strong tension between plot and story in this movie. What about the way that the camera seems to be situated in many of the spaces that you see? Compare that to things, well, the most obvious opposite would be Alexander Nevsky. But even Vertigo or 2001, very much it seems that the camera always in those movies is in very good sort of unity with the important action of the story, so that you never have a camera shot where, for instance, nothing is happening on the shot, but you can tell that some important stuff is happening off screen, right? But one of the things we're seeing in this movie is that the camera, very much in the way that the story and the plot are in tension, it seems that the camera and what's being filmed by the camera, in some sense, are in tension. That the camera, in a way, is just a sort of neutral observer, and the action unfolds around it. And if it's on camera, great. If not, then we get to perhaps then pay attention to other things in the scene that aren't perhaps the most important or most useful for telling the story. So look around for all these sorts of details. How does the film seem to heighten our awareness of the details that we normally perhaps ignore because we're too focused on the story, the big picture, the explanation for what the story means? This extends also to the use of actors in this movie in a variety of different ways. One, there's a lot of improvisation. In fact, I don't think there's a script to this film. It's mostly all a scene where people know that there's basic story that's supposed to happen, and they just improvise in the way that we typically improvise when we have conversations. Compare that to the painstaking act of writing a script and a screenplay wherein you constantly torture yourself to find just the right word versus just saying what you would say in a normal situation. But even beyond that, as far as I know, there are no professional actors in this movie. They're all untrained teenagers. It sounds horrible, but it actually works really well in this movie. So, these sorts of things. One other thing about this, which is important for science, it's going to be very different when we look at what's going on in a movie like Once Upon a Time in the West. But try to pay attention to the way that sound is recorded. This is the sort of thing without a lot of experience, it may not be very obvious, but sometimes it'll be quite obvious. And especially when we compare it to Once Upon a Time in the West tomorrow. But Much in the way that the camera seems to just be in space and in some way in counterpoint or perhaps even in tension with the action that it's recording, the sound recording functions in the same sort of way. But the sound recording sometimes, it's not always directed and oriented entirely towards creating the most sort of hi-fi, perfect sound recording of the dialogue of the sounds. And sometimes it seems very much like the most important sounds aren't actually even being recorded, and you hear other sounds in the environment in the way that the camera picks up other images that might not be immediately, say, useful for the story. So there's a lot of direct sound using just the microphone on set to record sounds instead of doing post-production dubbing, and so we'll talk a little bit about that next time. And finally, the use of deep focus in this film is really interesting, and you can go online and see some examples of deep focus in movies earlier than this, but the way that the focus of the camera very often creates a scene where instead of just the most important character or object or whatever being in the strongest focus, you have a very large image where everything is equally in focus. And very much like the camera placement and the microphone placement, it creates a situation in which we're sort of free to pay attention to the various other details as we wish, perhaps. Much in the way that 4 minutes 33 seconds, in a way, reveals all the sounds around us and invites us to listen to them. This film seems to do that with its images, its sounds, and also its story.